Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Wikipedia co-founder Larry Sanger on his Christian testimony.
I had no, sudden revelatory moment. It was slow and kind of painful and gradual. I thought I was being irrational. Yet, over and over again, I came to the realization that a lot of the sorts of questions that I have actually do have really persuasive answers.
That's Larry Sanger next. It was earlier this year that Wikipedia co-founder Larry Sanger decided to publicly acknowledge his faith in Christ and tell the story of how it happened. Larry, why did you want to tell this story?
I wanted to tell the story because I'm commanded to tell my story. Basically, the Great Commission states that we should go out and make disciples of all the world. And one of the most effective ways of doing that is to share basically the story of how you came to Jesus. And so that's what I'm doing.
People, when they hear you're one of the co-founders of Wikipedia, of course, that's an extremely interesting aspect of your story. Can you tell us why and how Wikipedia got started back in 2001?
It evolved out of a previous project that I also started called Newpedia. So Jimmy Wales, he was the CEO of a parent company, and he hired me to start Newpedia. That was moving very slowly. And a friend of mine told me about these kinds of websites that anybody could edit very easily, and called wikis. And so to make a long story short, I proposed to adopt that technology to solve the problem we were having with Newpedia, and that became Wikipedia. So I was there for the first 14 months or so, and then the dot-com boom turned to bust. And so I was actually laid off because they lost the ability to pay me. In the years that followed, I became actually more of a critic because essentially the management had allowed a lot of bad actors to take over and to, I would say, abuse the process. And a lot of those people are still involved. So,
and it is, I mean, extremely influential, right? Without a doubt.
For sure. No doubt.
Well, Larry, obviously this conversation isn't about Wikipedia. It's about you. It's about your Christian testimony. If you would, for starters, tell us about your upbringing, and particularly in matters of faith.
I was born in the Seattle area and baptized in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 7, we moved up to Anchorage, Alaska. Up until about the age of 12 or 13, I would say my family were pretty devout churchgoers. I remember going to a vacation Bible school and being confirmed and so forth. But then at about that same time, my parents were getting a divorce. And so fairly shortly after that, we stopped going to church. And my faith slipped away, essentially.
One thing particularly interesting was, and I can't remember the exact age that you were, but it seems like you wrote a lengthy blog post about this that people can read that gets into much more detail than we will be able to get into today. But you talk about an instance where, and you found that you were always a person that asked questions, and you had sincere questions, and you approached a pastor, and the response kind of shaped your life for quite a number of years.
Yeah, I wouldn't lay it all at the doorstep of that pastor. I forget which pastor it was, to be quite honest. Mm-hmm. I thought, what better person to answer some of these philosophical, skeptical questions that I had about the existence of God than a pastor well, I didn't know really about philosophy professors and that sort of thing, and apologetics really very much. Not too much, anyway. I expected him to be more pastoral. And he gave me the brush off, or that's my memory, anyway. He didn't seem to take my concerns seriously, and he even seemed perhaps a little threatened my line of questioning, or at least that's how it seemed to me at the time. I was probably not sufficiently respectful to him, you know, a snot-nosed teenager and all.
Moving through, at some point, you settled on philosophy as your career, even earning a PhD in it and even teaching it. How did you settle on philosophy, and how would you define philosophy?
I would define philosophy as basically the examination of the fundamental concepts and beliefs that underlie the way that we think about the world in general. So it's the most general subject, you could say. Could go into great detail here. Suffice to say that a lot of people in my life seem to have made unforced errors that were based on falsehoods that they accepted. And I thought it was extremely important, maybe the most important thing that I could do, to essentially ensure that I not make such errors. So I adopted as a sort of methodological, truth-seeking method, in other words, of skepticism. So it's called methodological skepticism, which is the idea that you should just get rid of all of your beliefs, start from ground zero, and build them back one by one based on things that you know to be true, in a nutshell. And of course, one of the things that I couldn't show to be true was the existence of God. I was just naturally inclined to the subject. And because I thought, truth seeking was so important, I actually decided to become a college professor before I even got to college in philosophy. And that's how it actually ended up for a while. Although by the time I was actually a visiting assistant professor for a few years, I had already decided not to pursue that as a career.
Now, it's interesting, Larry, you said the version or the description of the kind of philosophy that you followed or embraced was methodological skepticism, and your purpose was to seek the truth, which certainly seems very, very noble. So you were a skeptic, but as I understand it, you weren't hostile necessarily to Christianity or to belief in God. You just didn't know whether or not there was a God.
Right. I mean, philosophers use the words agnostic and atheist in a particular way. And agnostic is someone who neither believes that God does not exist nor believes that God does exist. In other words, an agnostic doesn't take a position one way or the other, whereas an atheist positively asserts that God does not exist. So I was not hostile at all. I admitted that it was possible. In fact, I even admitted that some of people that I knew or knew of appeared to be rational in their belief in God. It's just I couldn't share their belief because I thought the arguments were just no good.
Now, obviously, there were a lot of things going on in your writing and in your thinking up until a very critical point, sort of a line of demarcation, you might say, in 2019. There were some news stories that you were following, as I recall. There were some things that began to shape your thought about the world and about the state of the world and even the state or nature of human beings.
Right. So I was really disturbed by the reporting about Jeffrey Epstein, and then from there I learned about other similar circles of pedophiles, quite frankly. The Nexium case involved that. Hollywood is famous for this problem, which no one seems to do anything about. And then, of course, there's the Sir Jimmy Savile and the Rotherham scandals in the UK. And what a friend of mine told me, I didn't really believe him, but I thought, I guess it's possible,
yeah,
that these people have paganism or New Age beliefs, or you might even call it a Satanism in common. And I thought that was pretty strange. And he said, look at the evidence. These are like, here are some books that they endorse. And he'd like had me look up some of these sorts of occult type books. And I didn't really want to touch it. Not that I concluded immediately that, you know, there was something to that. It's just that, well, being a skeptic and leaving my mind open about issues, I thought, well, what if it does? What if there is something to it? And the reason these people are doing crazy things, these insanely evil things, is that they actually are in touch with you know, demons or whatever. I said I wanted any such spiritual doors left shut.
Mm-hmm.
I thought if anything, if I wanted to learn about what they think, it would be best to begin by reading the Bible all the way through for good understanding, because they are a reaction to that. A lot of the occult is essentially a perversion of Christian symbols and ideas. So I decided to actually read the Bible, although this wasn't until the following winter, and read it all the way through for good understanding. For that reason, I had no notion that I was going to like change my mind about the existence of God. I would have kind of laughed at the idea, I suppose.
So this is 2019. You decided right to read the Bible all the way through, and you had, so that's to say, you had not read the Bible prior to that point, or had not read it from cover to cover.
Not cover to cover. I was reasonably familiar with it. Mm-hmm. Like I homeschooled my boys, and we had actually read a few chapters, you know, key chapters, maybe a gospel, maybe, Genesis and half of Exodus and that sort of thing.
So you decided to read the Bible in its entirety in 2019, and tell us what your experiences were, how your thought process was affected, how your life was affected.
As soon as I decided to read the Bible for good understanding, I could tell that I was going to need some sort of commentaries or a study Bible to help, because there's a lot of stuff that is confusing, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I started doing that. And I'm also very good at internet search and all the rest of that. And so I looked up answers to my questions, and I was kind of shocked to discover that not only had all of my probing sorts of questions, what I thought were probing questions about the Bible, had been anticipated, but many more that I hadn't thought of also had been anticipated, and that the answers, while I didn't immediately accept them or anything, they actually made a system which, the more I came to understand it, the more sense it made. And then at the same time that was going on, I was just sort of naturally thinking back over the old arguments for the existence of God, which I had taught. I taught philosophy of religion a couple of times, and I taught the arguments many times to undergraduates. So I was very familiar with them, but I always found them to be really unpersuasive. But I seemed to be understanding slightly different, new-to-me versions of the arguments.
Mm.
And also understanding something that I'd never understood before, namely that each of the classic arguments for the existence of God has a certain role in an overall case for the existence of God. So the argument from contingency can be used to make a plausible case that a necessary being exists, and the argument from causality that there is a cause of the universe, and the argument from design that there is a mind-like designer of the universe, and so forth. And the idea is maybe individually these sorts of arguments aren't very good, but when you put them all together, then you can actually construct a case, something that logicians call an argument to the best explanation. And I had never thought of that before. You know, when I sort of stumbled across that thought, which is not original or anything, it made a big impression on me. The subtlety I found with which the Bible speaks, and that is able to be laid bare by theologians and apologists, is so great. I was really surprised. I didn't think that the Bible was particularly special as an ancient text. I just thought it was like another ancient storybook, essentially. But I don't think that anymore. I think there is something truly special about it. And that isn't just because I believe it either. I think that it carries a kind of plausibility for multiple reasons I have no time to get into. I slowly grew to believe what I was reading. Let's put it that way.
Now, would you put yourself in the category of, I suppose, like a C.S. Lewis? He described himself, well, there's a title of a movie as well. I mean, the most reluctant convert, but he was sort of felt like he was dragged kind of kicking and screaming. He was an atheist professor at one time. Did you find yourself feeling a little bit that way?
Yeah, I read Mere Christianity, but I never actually read his conversion story. Mm. And it's been described to me over the last month. And yes, actually, I really do want to read that. I think it's called Surprised by Joy. Mm. Isn't that one of them?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, I got to read that. Yes, I was not, I had no, you know, a sudden revelatory moment. It was slow and kind of painful and gradual. I thought I was being irrational. Yet, over and over again, I came to the realization that a lot of the sorts of questions that I have actually do have really persuasive answers. And when you put together the case from natural theology, in other words, all those old arguments for the existence of God, with revealed theology, or the strength of prophecy and the sheer wisdom and beauty of the Bible, and the message of redemption that it contains, the whole thing became really compelling to me. And that was really, it didn't take that long before, you know, my imagined conversations with God were turning to what I would call prayer, and that I was taking myself to pray to the God of the Bible. It took several more months after that before I was able to say that, yeah, I guess I am a Trinitarian. I do believe that there are, you know, three persons and so forth, to the theologians out there and the apologists, you know, there, I would say thank you, and that their work is not lost on people like me. You know, at the right time, their work is very important when it comes to shoring up a growing faith.
And at some point here, whenever it was 2019, 2020, it dawned upon you that you actually believed in the Jesus of the Bible as your savior.
I did. It took some time. Like, I knew the theology, even about, you know, the atonement and so forth. Why did Jesus have to die on the cross and so forth? Mm-hmm. Before I really was feeling it, so to speak, if you know what I'm saying.
It's, yeah,
like, okay, yes, of course I know that I do wrong. But I didn't have this notion of conviction that I was sinning against God. That's how I would put it now. Now I feel it absolutely fully. I get it. But it takes, you don't, some people anyway, don't immediately see that. I think some people do. But for some people like I was, there are barriers in the way that sort of you need to get out of the way. But in my case, I suppose it's the idea that I actually had a fairly good understanding of natural law ethics that doesn't even require a god to explain right and wrong. I still believe that, but I also think that God is the creator of the natural order, and that I am indeed sinning against him and the order that he has created, against life itself. That's the nature of sin, to undermine life.
I'm wondering, either prior to this 2019 reading of the Bible or even at the same time, were you personally interacting with, did you have friends or family members who were Christians?
Of course I had family members who were Christians, but I didn't tell anybody really what was going on in my head for many months. I didn't even, like, I think it came as a surprise to my Christian family. Maybe the most surprised was my wife and my boys. Because, I mean, I grew up, I'm sorry, very sorry, actually, that I sort of led them to unbelief, not actively. I actually tried to make it an open question for them. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I needn't get into that, but it was a kind of a surprise for them. And a lot of my old friends, I still haven't even talked to about it because I've just lost touch.
But your story is... has become very interesting very quickly. I think that you wrote your testimony on your blog. What? It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
What do you attribute the interest? I mean, there's a lot of interest in your story.
I don't really know. It's hard to say for sure. I think a lot of people have the sorts of doubts that I was very willing to entertain. I think a lot of people are put off from their doubts. They're scared of their doubts because they are unequal to actually resolving them. They can't, they're scared of not being able to come up with an answer and losing their faith, essentially. So I suppose I understand that. And you know, maybe they can point to me, but not just me, of course. Many people like me are out there who actually understand just what they're believing and why they believe it, at least to a great extent, and who are, you know, one of my favorite things in life is to ask questions about the Bible, questions that if I were to ask in some Bible studies, I'm sure they would think that I was a non-believer or something. It's just, I think that the answers are extremely edifying. Mm-hmm. They deepen one's faith if you actually get to the right answers. So,
I did want to ask. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Why did God have to kill the women and children? You know, why did he order? He didn't kill them directly himself. Why did he order the Israelites to do so? That's like one of the hardest ones. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think about. And there are deep, deep and important answers to that question.
Can you answer that? I know our time is going very quickly, but you raised the question. How have you concluded? What is your conclusion to that question?
I think that God cares most about innocent life. And you have to understand that the reason that he basically punishes truly, truly, how shall I say, evil countries, peoples in the Bible is that life has become so hopeless that it actually is a mercy to the children to... that they be killed, that their life, that no one's life can be satisfactory in any way under certain circumstances. It's very hard thing to say, and it's very rare historically, I think. But God is saying that things really can get that bad. And there's a lot more that can be said about that, but that's one piece of the puzzle. And in my book, actually, I talk about it quite a bit. So.
And this is your book, God Exists, A Philosophical Case for the Existence of God.
It's not likely to come out for a few years, I'm sure. I'm working on it diligently, but slowly.
And did I read maybe on your blog that it's over 500 pages now?
It's over 600 pages now.
Oh, my. Well, Larry, I know I have to let you go. My guest, Dr. Larry Sanger, co-founder of Wikipedia, believer in Jesus, really for a number of years now, and the president of the Knowledge Standards Foundation. Larry, before we recorded this interview, we were talking just briefly about apologetics. And of course, as you said, it's an extremely valuable field and has given you some definitely some things to think about. And yet at the same time, what are your thoughts on communicating the faith to non-believers and doing that perhaps with the use of apologetics? How could you help us do that better?
Yeah, unbelievers such as I was, mm-hmm. I can tell you that from a rational skeptic's point of view, a lot of the sorts of arguments that are made by apologists are just not persuasive. It's easy to poke holes if you're smart enough, basically. The important thing, actually, is to it isn't so much empathy, it is a intellectual comprehension of their point of view, actually being able to articulate their counter-arguments as well as they do, not being afraid of them. I can do that myself. You know, I think I have good answers for practically all of the sorts of objections that I would have raised before. And I think basically you do your apologetic no favors if you are just too glib. If you take a merely dismissive approach, you really have to show that you understand and respect the contrary position, or you're just not going to make a dent in them. And partly this is a matter of rhetoric, you know, just like you're trying to persuade someone, so you have to like treat them with respect. But part of it is actually just like academic intellectual standards about how we politely discuss things with people we disagree with. So I guess I'll just leave it at that.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Wikipedia co-founder Larry Sanger. You can read his story at larrysanger.org. Larry is also president of the Knowledge Standards Foundation. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's Ken Samples on how we got the Bible and why we can trust it.
You know, for the last 400 years, there are critical scholars who weren't necessarily believers who, you know, examined every single word, who have challenged it, questioned it, raised all kinds of criticisms against it. But it remains a remarkable book. I don't see any other book that could have withstood that kind of criticism.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.